Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. One was a preacher just in his 30s and the author of a mass movement to upend American apartheid. The other was a profane Texan and battle-scarred politician who put all his presidential chips on the table for civil rights. In 1964 and 5 and 8, Martin Luther King and Lyndon Baines Johnson together pushed through historic legislation that changed a nation. This hour on Point, MLK, LBJ, and the high-wire relationship behind the civil rights revolution. I have two great guests with me today. Joining us from Washington, D.C. is Roger Wilkins. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, civil rights activist, and now professor of history and American culture at George Mason University. As a young man, he served as assistant attorney general in the Lyndon B. Johnson administration. He knew both President Johnson and Reverend King and saw how the two worked together. Civil rights runs in his family. His uncle, Roy Wilkins, was executive secretary of the NAACP from 1955 to 1977. Roger Wilkins, thank you very much for being with us today.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
And with us from Washington is journalist and historian Nick Kotz. He's also a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter on the beat in the 1960s and beyond. He's author of the celebrated history out in 2005, Judgment Days, Lyndon Baines Johnson, Martin Luther King Jr., and the Laws That Changed America. Nick Kotz, thank you very much for joining us.
It's my pleasure.
Mr. Kotz, I wish we could come first to you just for your kind of opening characterization of this relationship. It's been much in the news in the last couple of weeks, and we're not here to sort of relive all of that debate, but we thought, what if Martin Luther King did to go back and look at this relationship? How did these two men get along? When were they first and most thrown together?
President Johnson and Dr. King were thrown together on November 22, 1963, when President Kennedy was killed. We were in the midst of a national crisis. At that point, Dr. King and the civil rights movement was trying to push through what would become the 1964 civil rights law. Suddenly, we had a new president. Johnson and King individually saw a great opportunity. The country was in mourning. Johnson and King both realized that if they could get the country that was feeling very guilty to pass this law in honor of President Kennedy, it might help the cause. That's when they came together, and both were trying to accomplish the same thing.
You know, we're going to hear a lot of tape in this hour. Roger Wilkins, I wish you'd listen with us for just a minute and a half here to a conversation, and then give us your kind of interpretation of this. But here is a conversation recorded by the White House. It's a conversation between LBJ and Martin Luther King on November 25th, 1963, 3 days after the assassination of John F. Kennedy, and on the evening after that day's burial of JFK in Arlington National Cemetery. It opens with LBJ.
And a good many people told me that they heard about your statement, I guess, on TV, wasn't it?
Yes, that's right.
I've been locked up in this office, and I haven't seen it, but I won't tell you how grateful I am and how worthy I'm going to try to be of all your hopes.
Well, thank you very much. I'm so happy to hear that, and I knew that you had just that great spirit, and you know you have our support and backing.
Well,
because we know what a difficult period this is.
It's just an impossible period. We've got a budget coming up that's got nothing to do with it. It's practically already made, and we got a civil rights bill that hadn't even passed the House, and it's November, and Hubert Humphrey told me yesterday everybody wanted to go home. We got a tax bill that they haven't touched, and we just got to not let up on any of them and keep going, and I guess they'll say that I'm repudiated, but I'm going to ask the Congress Wednesday to just stay there till they pass them all. They won't do it, but we'll just keep them there next year till they do, and we just won't give up an inch.
Well, this is mighty fine. I think it's so imperative. I think one of the great tributes that we can pay in memory of President Kennedy is to try to enact some of the great progressive policies that he sought to initiate.
Well, I'm going to support them all, and you can count on that, and I'm going to do my best to get other men to do likewise, and I'll have to have y'all's help. I never needed more than I do now.
Well, you know you have it, and just feel free to call on us for anything.
LBJ and Martin Luther King 3 days after the assassination of John F. Kennedy. Roger Wilkin, White House tapes have been controversial over the years, but the privilege of getting to listen back into this makes us glad there was some tape recorder running there. And it sounds almost like two pros laying out a strategy. JFK is dead. Let's take the energy of grief around that and move on an agenda here. Mr. Wilkins?
Well, I was amused to hear President Johnson again being so Johnson. The thing is, Martin could talk, and Martin would just roll on and on, but Johnson could talk too.
Yeah, world class each.
That's right, but Johnson overwhelmed you, and he just came at you with his words and his. Because he had such energy, and that's what I hear in that. I hear him listening a while to King, figuring out where King is coming from, and then boring in with, and it's delightful. Now, I have to believe that very early on, before this conversation occurred, Johnson figured, okay. I will use the death of President Kennedy and his memory to get this civil rights bill through. And it seems to me that in this conversation, he was putting that idea into King's head because he wanted King with him on this journey.
Nick Kotz, and here you have Martin Luther King just laying that strategy out quite clearly. One of the great tributes that we can pay a memory of President Kennedy, he says, is to get some of these progressive policies through. Remind us. I mean, it wasn't long after this that the Civil Rights Bill, in fact, went through. Then we get to the Voting Rights Bill. Then we get to the Open Housing Bill in 1968. We'll have many listeners for whom this is ancient history. These were gigantic legislative footsteps in American history.
Indeed, they were. The 1964 Civil Rights Act abolished official segregation in the South, outlawed employment discrimination all over the country, and put the federal government into action where the federal government would not approve any programs for state or local government that practiced discrimination. It was the biggest breakthrough since the Emancipation Proclamation 100 years earlier.
The Kennedys had talked about such steps but had not really embraced Martin Luther King. They hadn't really been aggressive champions of this movement. How did these two men then read each other? How did Martin Luther King read LBJ, Nick Kotz, and the potential of this president to be a partner in this effort?
This is Roger Wilkins.
Yes, please.
Let me say that I was a witness to the relationship between the civil rights movement and the Kennedys. And there was the Kennedys did not understand King. He was a Southerner. He was a preacher. These phrases rumbled out of his spirit and his mouth. And they wanted crisp people. They wanted policy people. They were comfortable with crisp policy people. Some of their people tried to get me to manipulate my uncle, who was a Northerner and was a crisp policy person.
Roy Wilkins, head of the NAACP then.
Mm-hmm. Right. And they would come at a party, they would come by and say, you know, your uncle is the one we really rely on. We really respect.
That is instead of MLK.
Right. I knew that was a signal to me to tell my uncle, step it up, and they'll be receptive. And they would also come to me with the criticisms of King. They came to me and said, we think that he's just doing a terrible thing down there in Birmingham using those kids. And I guess that was a signal to me to say something to King or to say something to my uncle or both. But I just said to them, they are teaching. What Martin and his lieutenants are teaching these kids is that they can be citizens of the United States who have the ability to shape their own futures. And that's a more powerful lesson than they will ever learn in those segregated schools that they're now consigned to. Well, that stopped them. They never came back to me with that kind of stuff. But Johnson was a Southerner. He understood King and his spirit and his religion. And Johnson had known poor people. The Kennedys had not known black people very much or poor people very much. That's not to denigrate the Kennedys or to criticize them. It's just who they were and the limitation of their background.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the Martin Luther King LBJ Partnership on Civil Rights, the men, their relationship, and who brought what to the table in the heart of the civil rights revolution of the 1960s. Roger Wilkins joins us. He was Assistant Attorney General in the LBJ, Lyndon Baines Johnson administration, Pulitzer Prize winner, now professor of history and American culture at George Mason University. Nick Kotz is with us, Pulitzer Prize winning reporter himself. In the 1960s, he worked as Washington correspondent for the Des Moines Register, the Minneapolis Tribune, author of the great 2005 book, and I highly recommend it, Judgment Days, Lyndon Baines Johnson, Martin Luther King Jr., and the Laws That Changed America. We all heard this relationship back in the news in the contest of Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama in recent weeks. I just want to get these voices in our ear a bit more. Here's LBJ in a speech to the full Congress on March 15, 1965, a week after the later violence, not Birmingham, but this time Selma, Alabama, led by Martin Luther King, the protest there. Here's the president, LBJ, using the phrase, "We shall overcome," a phrase he borrowed, of course, from the African-American civil rights struggle.
What happened in Selma is part of a far larger movement which reaches into every section and state of America. It is the effort of American Negroes to secure for themselves the full blessings of American life. Their cause must be our cause too, because it's not just Negroes, but really it's all of us who must overcome the crippling legacy of bigotry and injustice. And we shall overcome.
Those famous words in the mouth of a Southern president, March 15th, 1965. Here, just 10 days later, Martin Luther King standing on the steps of the state capitol building in Montgomery, Alabama, after marching from Selma. Here's an excerpt from his speech, now known as Our God is Marching On.
I come to say to you this afternoon, however difficult the moment,
yes, sir,
however frustrating the hour, it will not be long, because truth crushed to earth will rise again.
Yes, sir.
How long? Not long.
Yes, sir.
Because no lie can live forever.
Yes, sir.
How long? Not long.
How long?
Because you shall reap what you sow.
Yes, sir.
How long?
How
not long?
Long. How long?
Truth forever on the scaffold, wrong forever on the throne.
Yes,
yet that scaffold sways the future.
Yes.
Behind the dim unknown standeth God within the shadow, keeping watch above his own. How long? Not long. Because the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends toward justice.
Yes, sir.
How long?
Not
long.
Not long.
Because mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord.
Yes, sir.
Martin Luther King, March 25th, 1965. Nick Kotz, there's both men, each man in his element in a way. Talk about this partnership, and in all of your research, how do you see the roles of each, what each brought to the table in this epic struggle?
President Johnson was Mr. Inside. He was the man who knew how to manipulate the levers of power in Washington, how to get legislation passed. Dr. King was Mr. Outside. Dr. King didn't know much about Washington, and as Roger said, Washington didn't understand him. He was Mr. Outside. His role and the role of the civil rights movement, all of the organizers, the tens of thousands of people, were to, and his strategy was to put pressure on the government in Washington to arouse the support of people of goodwill, white people of goodwill around the country, and to keep pressure on the government. And the two segments you just played, King at Selma and Montgomery, was the ultimate example of putting pressure on the government. The people marched. They were beaten bloody by sheriff's deputies. The country watched this and was appalled. Johnson needed the pressure of the civil rights movement to be able to pass the legislation. That was the political dynamic that was going on.
Roger Wilkins, you lived through it. You were in the thick of it. How do you look at the relative nature or weight of the contribution of these two men? The notion that was kind of put out there in the current political debate was one was the dreamer and one was the doer. That's oversimplifying, but that's sort of how it came across. How do you look back?
Well, if anybody who suggests that one was the dreamer and one was the doer doesn't really understand the nature of transformational politics in the United States. Let me give you the best example I know. Mm. When I first came to Washington, I was 31 years old, and I was working for the Agency for International Development. But
under JFK.
Under JFK. But I was my soul was just ripped up and pushed and dynamited into action by the Freedom Riders and by other really brave people working in the South to destroy segregation and get the vote.
People risking their lives there, very clearly.
Absolutely, risking their lives. And I was grousing to my boss, the administrator, about how slow I thought the Kennedy administration was in dealing with this. And he told me a story about Franklin Roosevelt. He said that Roosevelt had a supporter and a friend named Sidney Hillman, who was head of the International Ladies Garment Workers Union, a major union in New York and in the country at that time. And Hillman had been a supporter of Roosevelt's when Roosevelt was governor. And he had supported Roosevelt strongly in the campaign of 1932, where Roosevelt won the presidency. Hillman, therefore, was a welcome visitor to the Oval Office, and he would come in and he would say, "Now, Mr. President, this is what we need to do." And he'd have all kinds of papers, and he'd have programs that had to be done, and he would, because they were trying to combat the Depression. And he'd get through, and Roosevelt would look at him and say, "Sidney, I agree with everything you say, and I think those programs are wonderful. Now you go back home, organize, and make me do it.
Make me, the president, do it."
That's right. That's right. So that the president, when he comes to the Congress and proposes legislation, the Congress knows that the people in the United States are clamoring for it. Well, as Nick will tell you, there could not have been a more devoted apostle of Franklin Roosevelt than Lyndon B. Johnson, who, when as a young man, worked in the Roosevelt administration, worked on programs for poor people, had terrific empathy, and although he said time and time again in the 60s, I intend to finish what Lincoln began, I always listened to him when he said that and said, what you're fixing, what you're finishing is what Roosevelt began. Mm. So,
but here we were with another...
And President Johnson was highly competitive. He was most interested in his place in history. He had people in the White House keeping score on how fast he got bills passed versus how fast FDR did during the first 100 days. And Johnson was determined to equal his hero or mentor, or if possible, to surpass him.
But on this question of who brought what to the table in this relationship, Roger Wilkins, you're saying that like FDR, he needed the pressure from the field. Again, because of the tapes made then, there's some remarkable evidence of this. I've got a bit here from a telephone call. This is between Martin Luther King and LBJ on January 15th, 1965. That was Martin Luther King's 36th birthday. Think about that, young Americans. He was only 36 years old in the heart of all this. Of course, the Voting Rights Amendment is what's on the table now. There are many, many counties in the South where only a tiny fraction of blacks are able to vote or registered to vote because of all kinds of impediments thrown up in their way. And here you hear LBJ talking about what Martin Luther King can do to help him push this on through. Let's listen.
You can contribute a great deal by getting your leaders and you yourself taking very simple examples of discrimination, where a man's got to memorize Longfellow, whether he's got to quote the first 10 amendments, or he's got to tell you what Amendment 15, 16, 17 is, and then ask them if they know, and show what happens. And some people don't have to do that, but when a Negro comes in, he's got to do it. And if we can just repeat and repeat and repeat, I don't want to follow Hitler, but he had an idea that if you just take a simple thing and repeat it often enough, even if it wasn't true, why, people accept it. Well, now, this is true, and if you can find the worst condition that you run into in Alabama, Mississippi, or Louisiana, or South Carolina, where I think one of the worst I ever heard of is the president of the school at Tuskegee, or the head of the government department there, or something, being denied the right to cast a vote. And if you just take that one illustration and get it on radio and get it on television and get it on in the pulpits, get it in the meetings, get it every place you can, pretty soon the fellow that didn't do anything but follow, drive a tractor, he'll say, well, that's not right, that's not fair. And then that will help us on what we're going to shove through and in.
Yeah, you're exactly right about that.
Now, there's LBJ doing almost all the talking in that particular clip, but everything he's talking about is what Martin Luther King can, he hopes, do to help him push this legislation through. Roger Wilkins, Nick Kotz, please stand by. A lot of listeners have been waiting to join this conversation with you, too. We've got Henry on the line from Marion, South Carolina. Henry, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Hate to rain nice water on all of this, but it just sounds to me like, even when Hillary Clinton brought it up, they have these dichotomies. I'm hearing outsider versus insider, and the dreamer versus the doer and all that. Where Hillary Clinton brought this up in a race where both she and Barack Obama were running for the same post as president, and what she was sort of saying was, things have not changed in the 40, 50 years since then, and so you still need to have, you know, somebody on the quote-unquote inside, which the real dichotomy is, you need someone white to push through stuff like this, because of all these dichotomies that I've heard, outside, inside, dream, do, no one has said black, white. And that was the true dichotomy that exists and still exists today. And so that is really what has caused this whole uproar, is that she's saying, well, you know, not Dr. Martin Luther King, you know, he talked it, but he couldn't do it. And, you know, she's really, you know, ascribing that to Barack Obama. Where we're in a situation where we have someone who not only is eloquent, but is also in the seat of power, the same seat that she's in the Senate. And so I think that she's counting on the very worst instincts of Americans to go back to say, well, no, we need someone who was more or less a puppeteer like LBJ, not taking anything away from him, but he never did win election to president, and I don't think he would ever have.
Well, the next time out, but Henry, we take your point, and I want to put it to Roger Wilkins. Mr. Wilkins, how about it, the reality then and now? You hear Henry's interpretation of current politics, but take us back as well to what was really going on.
Well, I sympathize with Henry's emotions. I don't agree entirely with his analysis. First of all, Johnson did win election mm-hmm. on his own in 1964, crushing Barry Goldwater. Secondly, I think that I was offended by Senator Clinton's remark. I thought that it was a put down of both Barack Obama and Martin King. I think that it really sounded like kind of a jealousy about the fact that Obama has this rhetorical skill which moves people profoundly, whereas Senator Clinton, for whatever her accomplishments may be, sounds like a policy wonk, which is what she has been, and she certainly knows her stuff, but she is not a person who is able to move people's emotions in any significant way, and I think that distresses her, and so she was trying to say, I think, you can be a talker if you want, but I'm a doer, and it's only the doers who get things done. Well, that is such a misconception of how the civil rights movement, so many pieces of legislation came out of the civil rights movement. It's wrong. It's foolish, her assessment, and I think ultimately not very honest.
Nick Kotz, it does seem a strange debate for Americans to be wrapped up in 40 and more years after this relationship, this partnership, pushed so much through.
Well, I think that's true. But as Roger was saying, there's a fundamental misunderstanding of those political dynamics. They were a lot more complicated than an orator and a dreamer and a doer. Let's start with Dr. King. Dr. King was and not just Dr. King, dozens of other civil rights leaders and organizers were brilliant strategists, brilliant tacticians. They had a plan. They were using nonviolent direct action to produce confrontation, and confrontation that would inevitably show the country, bring out the worst of the segregationist sheriffs and policemen.
To hold it high and change it. Nick Kotz, please hold the thought. We'll come right back to it. Roger Wilkins, also in Washington. We're talking about MLK and LBJ. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. We're talking this hour about the real Martin Luther King LBJ partnership on civil rights, the men, their relationship, and who brought what to the table in the heart of the civil rights revolution of the 1960s. Roger Wilkins was there as an assistant attorney general in the Johnson administration. He joins us from Washington, D.C. Nick Kotz, also Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, has written in great depth about it in his book Judgment Days, Lyndon Baines Johnson, Martin Luther King, and the Laws That Changed America. Nick, you were just in the process of laying out the two sides of this. I want to hear the rest of that, but as you do, let's just listen for another moment to that same phone call on Martin Luther King's 36th birthday, January 15th, 1965, call from the President Johnson to Martin Luther King And they're talking, King thanks Johnson for his State of the Union address he just made, said it was great. King says he thinks the country's headed in the right direction toward the Great Society.
I had a moment, I thought maybe we better try to, I better try to reply to your call.
Well, I certainly appreciate your return to call, and I don't want to take but just a minute of time. First, I want to thank you for that great State of the Union message. It was really a marvelous presentation. I think we're on the way now toward the Great Society.
I'll tell you what our problem is. We've got to try with every force at our command, and I mean every force, to get these education bills that go to those people under $2,000 a year income, $1.5 billion, this poverty that's $1.5 billion, and this health that's going to be $900 million next year, right at the bottom. We've got to get them passed before the vicious forces concentrate and get them a coalition that can block them.
There's a president putting everything on the line from the White House, and a great cultural movement leader, Martin Luther King, who's been putting everything at this point on the line in the streets, including his own life. Nick Kotz, take us on down through the calculus of this relationship and who brought what.
It's really an oversimplification, Tom, to reduce what was this momentous historic struggle to just two men. Dr. King could not have accomplished anything if there were not tens of thousands of African Americans and their white supporters who were willing to go out in the street day after day, risk being beaten, risk losing their jobs, maybe getting killed, because without that pressure from those tens of thousands of people, the dynamics would not have been created that would have forced the government to act and to give Johnson, a very skilled politician, the necessary public support to get it done. But Dr. King, I was starting to say before, and others in the civil rights movement were tremendous strategists and organizers. There's a moment in Selma that led to Johnson's We Shall Overcome speech and to King's triumphant speech standing outside the governor's capital in Alabama. There was a moment when they had run out of people to go to jail. And there was talk among some of the civil rights leaders, well, they've given us a thing or two. Maybe we ought to do some negotiating. And Dr. King, from jail in Selma, sent out to his lieutenants 11 points of what he wanted them to do. And each one of those points was keep on the pressure, no truces, because he knew that until a climax was reached, that there wouldn't be enough support to get it done. And in fact, he was right, because the demonstrations in Selma, people being beaten on the Edmund Pettus Bridge, being watched by people all over the country, eventually produced demonstrations in other southern cities. And people in Congress, in the House and the Senate, who were reluctant to move, realized they had to.
Roger Wilkins, that sounds entirely in its own terms like getting it done, but getting it done simply from another angle.
I'm not quite sure what your question is.
From jail, from the streets, even, you know, in Birmingham, as Nick points out, when there weren't enough adults who could step up, going to school children. But here's Martin Luther King with 11 points, sort of strategy outlined. He's not sitting in the Oval Office, but he's hardly less strategic and action and result oriented from the angle that he's got with the troops that he has.
Well, I think that a whole lot of people in the movement were strategic. Martin certainly was, and Martin was one of the things that there are a lot of things about Martin that people don't say. One of them was that he was very, very smart, and he didn't just stand up there and these wonderful things came out of nowhere. They came out of a spirit and a brain that that was really a profound brain. But you have to, if you think about Johnson's speech proposing the Voting Rights Act, you have to go back even before Martin. That is, before Martin was in the voting rights business, there was, and he's still alive, but there was a wonderful saint of a man named Bob Moses, who was a leader of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, who went by himself to a very dangerous town, Macomb, Mississippi, with a plan to teach sharecroppers and other poor black people how they could register to vote. You heard President Johnson talking about all the crazy burdens that were thrown in the way of blacks trying to vote in the South. This fellow went down by himself to teach people how to register and to vote and then to send them off to try to register. He was risking his life. They were risking their lives. In fact, he was severely injured. One of his people he tutored was killed. This was back in 61. We're talking about the Voting Rights Act of 65. The voting rights issue was raised by the NAACP in lawsuits in the 50s and the 60s, so that what you get in the Voting Rights Act, as Johnson was presenting it, is the culmination of a movement that just grew and grew. And as Nick said, it was not just blacks. It was blacks and whites who came down. And it was blacks and whites who lost their lives together. So that it made it possible for Johnson to use his legendary energy and focus and parliamentary skills to bring this act, the Voting Rights Act, to the Congress at the right time. And I can tell you, as a person who was in the government at the time and contributed to the discussions inside the federal government, that there were people inside the government who did not want to go as fast as Johnson wanted to go, particularly people in the Justice Department who had been drafting a voting rights act for a bill for a long time, and it was as if they were going to had to wait until they drafted a perfect bill. Well, Congress was going to put its hands on the bill, and there were people inside the government. I was one of them who just pushed and pushed and pushed and said, "Just send the bill up now," so that what had happened in the streets not only resonated in the ears and the spirit of President Johnson, but to many, many people in the federal government who pushed the president hard from their position.
A drama much bigger than two men here, but these two men at the center of it who were willing to credit one another, Martin Luther King telling LBJ after the 1964 Civil Rights Act, "You have created a second emancipation." Johnson responding with those legions of people who had put their lives on the line, that the real hero is the American Negro. Barbara's calling from Virginia Beach, Virginia. Hi, Barbara. You're on the air.
Yes, thank you. I'm a 64-year-old white Southern woman, educated, born, and lived through the segregated South. Fast forward to the present day, I am deeply disappointed to see Hillary Clinton or anyone, including perhaps the format of this program, question setting, couch the conversation in the terms that it is, because to suggest that Lyndon Johnson did more for civil rights than Martin Luther King is tantamount to saying that Lincoln did more for emancipation than Frederick Douglass. I wish the American conversation could take place with terminology such as collaboration, cooperation, celebration, instead of always, always competition. I have as much invested in the idea of a woman becoming president, the first president of the United States, as anyone else from my era. And I don't want to, you know, like, suggest one or the other of those two candidates. I'm just sorry that after not 40 years, but 400 years, we're still having this conversation. And it's not a fact that there is equality. There is still not equality, and civil rights still has to have another wave. I hope it won't be as painful and as bloody, but I feel that our country needs to wake up to the fact that civil rights is not a completed fact. That's all I wanted to say.
Barbara, thank you very much for that. Nick, I mean, Kotz, it's exactly that collaboration, that partnership that we're trying to flesh out in this conversation. How do you respond to Barbara's thoughts?
Well, I think Barbara is quite eloquent in talking about particularly the last thing she said. This is an incompleted civil rights revolution. The high water mark we've just been talking about, and we've heard the words at Selma and the passage of the Voting Rights Act. But unfortunately, that was the climax of the movement. Dr. King died, Lyndon Johnson died, both realizing that their hopes, their dreams to do more to make equality a reality by overcoming the problems of education, of poverty, of health. That didn't happen. One reason it didn't happen was there was an enormous backlash against Johnson and the people who passed the civil rights law. The other reason it happened was President Johnson led us deeper and deeper into Vietnam, and the money wasn't there. So neither the political support nor the money was there. Dr. King died, President Johnson died with their hopes and dreams incomplete. And the question is, when will the country pick up the cause effectively again?
Roger Wilkins, you used the phrase earlier in this hour, transformational politics. You and Nick lived through a time of that. You saw it firsthand, and both have written and spoken much about it. In this campaign season, there's so much talk about change. Do you feel, I mean, if change isn't transformational politics, I don't know what it is. Do you feel the elements of transformational politics at work in this country today or not?
I think that there is a strong desire, a strong recognition in the country that the country has gone off since 2001 on the wrong track. I think people have a sense that the war we're in is a bad war. It's just as they felt that the war we were in 1965 was a bad war. There has not been any significant investment by the government in our domestic situation in these years. We have been piling up massive debts to the Chinese mainly in order to fund this highly expensive war. And now the country is facing at least a recession. Don't know how significant it's going to be, but a lot of people are worried. So we're in a time when people are yearning for better leadership and idealistic leadership. And I think this could be a transformational moment, but I must say that I don't see a coherent movement outside the government today the way the civil rights movement was in the early 60s or as the anti-war movement was in the late 60s.
Roger Wilkins, Nick Kotz, with that, we're out of time, but I thank you both for being with us. Nick Kotz, Judgment Day, is Roger Wilkins in Washington. Thank you to both of you.
Thank
you. You're welcome. Thank you.
Great to have you both. Let's just go out with the words of LBJ in the great issue of his day on this Martin Luther King Day as we celebrate that collaboration, that partnership.
There is no Negro problem. There is no Southern problem. There is no Northern problem. There is only an American problem.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Thank you.